Are you feeling overwhelmed by hormonal changes? If you're a woman, you're not alone. With over 1,000 hormone disruptors in our environment, it's no wonder things can feel out of balance. On top of that, natural changes like PMS, menopause, and other life stages can leave you feeling tired, irritable, and trapped in a constant battle with your body. But here's the good news. You don't have to suffer through it. Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth is here to help. This herbal formula fine-tunes your hormones, balancing estrogen, testosterone, and even stress hormones like cortisol, which can contribute to weight gain, racing thoughts, poor sleep, and more. With over 40,000 five-star reviews and a bottle selling every 24 seconds, the results speak for themselves. Ready to feel like yourself again? For a limited time, get 15% off your first order at happymammoth.com using code NEXTCHAPTER at checkout. Visit happymammoth.com today and get your old self back naturally.
Welcome to Queer Storytime, the podcast. This is a brave space for sharing queer and trans stories of radical affirmation, acceptance, empowerment, and healing. I'm your host, Stevie Ingram. I so look forward to you joining us. If you haven't done so already, please be sure to subscribe to this podcast. Alrighty, y'all, queer in 3, 2, 1. Let's go. Welcome back to the post-Pride Queer Story Time. You're tuned in to episode number 12. I sincerely hope each and every single one of you had a fabulous Pride and that you got to truly celebrate your identity, even if you're just coming into an internal awareness and acceptance of who you really are. From this episode on, we'll be getting back into the normal scheduling of Queer Storytime. As the last Pride Month episode, I wanted to release that episode on the historical date of these Stonewall protests on June 28th to honor all of our queer and trans elders that came before us to get us to where we are today. If it weren't for our fierce queer and trans elders and their relentless advocacy, we would not be making the progress our community has in its modern era. So on behalf of the entire queer and trans community, we're sending ongoing blessings of love and gratitude to all of our queer and trans elders who have made so much possible for our community today. With all of this said, I'd like to sit for a moment of mindfulness as we allow these feelings of gratitude for our queer and trans elders to continue to arise within us. As we enter this brief moment of awareness, just naturally feeling the ebb and flow of breath. As you continue to tune in to this felt sense and awareness of gratitude, notice where in the body the gratitude is arising within you. Is it in the heart center? Is it in the abdomen or somewhere else in the body? Taking a few more moments of conscious awareness. Thanking all of our queer and trans ancestors. Those alive and already past, for all that they've done for our community. Taking one more deep breath here, inhaling. And deeply exhaling. And gently opening your eyes as you're ready to reintegrate into the space that surrounds you. Now to present our guest for this episode, Ali Patel. Ali is a trailblazing LGBTQ plus scholar, activist, and influencer who has made monumental strides for queer South Asian women. Ali pioneered Canadian research on queer South Asian women's issues and solely founded the Queer South Asian Women's Network, a thriving national organization. In 2020, Ali made LGBTQ plus history as the first South Asian speaker of Pride Toronto's Dyke March, and again in 2020 as the first queer South Asian speaker at the Ontario government's Pride flag raising ceremony. She is a Toronto-based South Asian lesbian power dyke, and Ali recently published her first book, Don't Tell My Parents, Queer Diasporic Truths, and you can learn more about her at alipatel.com. So welcome, Ali, to Queer Storytime. Why don't you start out by sharing a bit about yourself and your life's journey thus far?
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I would love to. So you pretty much covered all of my bases in terms of what I do. I'm an LGBTQ plus activist. I focus largely on wanting to create visibility for queer South Asian women, particularly in North American diasporic, like Western LGBTQ plus communities where there isn't historically given a lot of space for us, despite queerness always existing in South Asian culture. I'm also currently doing my PhD, so I've also pioneered research in this area. And apart from that, my life's journey, I've had a lot of interesting ups and downs. So I think one thing that I love to actually talk about a lot is the fact that, so I'm actually not out to my parents. And so despite doing all of this public facing work, my parents don't really know. Like, my mom kind of knows, my dad knows nothing. But even though my mom kind of has like some idea, it's very much anytime it comes up, it's like, don't tell anyone, no one can find out. Like, your dad can't find out, extended relatives can't find out. And she only kind of knows because I've been like outed before. And so it's been an interesting journey. I currently live across the country from them, and that kind of, I think, helps me protect my safety a little bit. But yeah, every day I kind of just wake up and I'm like, I'm choosing violence. But, and like, I'm saying that in a joke, as a joking way a little bit, but for me, the most important thing is that we are able to create these safer spaces and this visibility for queer South Asian, you know, women and trans and non-binary individuals, because as like a queer South Asian person, it is just so lonely and exhausting to feel so exiled from both of these communities. So as long as people feel, you know, seen from my work, for me, it feels worth it to have had the family backlash and constantly, you know, being on edge and at risk of just worse outcomes from family if they do find out. But yeah, I think that's just an interesting fact. I don't know. Every day I'm like, wow, I'm really relying on the fact that my parents don't really know how to use the internet. And hopefully that doesn't change.
Wow. Thinking so much about, as you articulate all of this, the inner conflict that you feel, but you also have this bold and fierce personality just as your natural self. I mean, how, like, honestly in your heart does it feel being this outspoken person? You're doing your PhD, you're doing all this scholarship in the queer and trans space, and then your family doesn't fully know or maybe even comprehend what this means for you.
To be absolutely honest, I know I'm like, I love to bring out my bubbly personality all the time, but I sit with a lot of grief. Like, I would even say it's chronic grief to this point, because I love sharing everything about my life. I love sharing my happy moments. And it's really hard that I can't share these exciting things with my family and with my work. Like, I think they're like, okay, you know, you're always busy, you're doing stuff. They don't know exactly what I'm doing. I mean, it's South Asian culture. It's pretty rare to hear your parents say, I'm proud of you. So it's not that I'm expecting something like that, but it is kind of just one of those things where I'm like, you know, I'm like happily in a relationship and I wish I could share that. And I wish I could have that big wedding, and not even a big wedding. Just, I wish that I could foresee it a time where it's like, you know, I can see my parents coming to my wedding, my ceremony, or I wish I can go to my mom for relationship advice. I feel like I would have not been in so many abusive relationships, like queer relationships, if I had been able to just go and talk to my mom and be like, hey, this is what's going on. Like, can you give me some advice? Because my mom does give really good like relationship advice, and I've seen it. Growing up, I grew up really, really close to my mom, and I still am close to her. So I think for me, that's kind of my point of grief, where it's like, I wish I could just tell you everything I do. She might not understand it, but if I'm happy, she would be happy for me. There's that. And then there's also like seeing my friends get married and how their families are there. I'm so happy for them. And for me, it's, I think, a little bit of just like, I just wish my family could be there, and I wish I could share all of the exciting things I do with them, but I can't. And I can't extensively talk about, my research, or I can't extensively talk about my activism. I think it's hard too, because I'm trying to balance in a way where, like, even when I go back to Ontario, like, I'll stay with my family, but I'm doing a talk and it's like, yeah, I'm going to go speak at a thing. And they're like, oh, what are you speaking about? I'm like, oh, just, South Asian women and mental health. And like, I'll make up an excuse and fabricate it. So they don't know the extent of, I guess, the impact of my work. I wish I could tell them these things, but I can't. And it kind of feels like, I tell my sister sometimes and like she's excited, but for me, it's also like, you have to keep this a secret. And I feel like I'm kind of dragging her into it sometimes. Or like, I think it's one of those things where I'm like, well, obviously people shouldn't tell my parents. And when I was younger and doing this, it was like, why would anyone tell my parents? Like, this isn't like blah, 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 whatever. And like, 100%, that's still correct. I think for me, it's just at this age, and I guess the fact that I'm still going with it as I'm getting older, I wish it's something that I can envision myself seeing this big happy family. Like all my cousins know, my aunts, uncle, like I wish that could happen. I can't. And I made my peace with it, but I still do sit with the grief sometimes that I wish I could still have all of that with my current partner, who is just so great and would be so fitting in our family and all this stuff.
Could you talk about, for those that are familiar, because I've spent a long time studying your culture as somebody that studied yoga and Buddhism. One of my prior guests here on Queer Storytime, her name is Anuradha Gupta. She's an Ayurvedic practitioner. And she's also the mother of a lesbian daughter. She's like super, super outspoken for the community, which is a blessing. But can you talk about what you see as like in your research and as a PhD scholar, what you see as the conditions which have created this lack of acceptance for our queer South Asian brothers and sisters and non-binary folks?
Absolutely. So in South Asia, before the colonial era, being like queer and like sexuality and gender was very fluid, normal, and accepted in South Asian culture. There weren't really terms for it, like gay or lesbian, but it was just something that was so normal that we didn't really need language for it. But then colonialism happened, and the British Empire actually came on something called the Sexual Civilizing Mission. So it was very intentional. They came and they violently erased all mentions of queerness in our scriptures. They imposed homophobia. They legally criminalized queerness. They violently erased it from cultural memory and made it so it's shameful and a bad thing, which was all very much at the time Western sentiment. And so because of that, now, there's a South Asian culture where everyone kind of thinks it's bad, but it's not. It wasn't initially part of our culture in the first place. And so in the West, when the LGBTQ plus movement happened, South Asia was kind of like left out of it, right? Because now there's this idea that's like, oh, what, like South Asia is so backwards for not accepting queerness, and look at the West, are so progressive, when in fact, the West is the reason why queerness is not accepted in South Asian culture. And so it becomes a little hard, because now there's even this belief in many South Asian families that queerness is a Western concept, and families, immigrate here and their kids are queer. It's like, oh, you're just so assimilated. Like, this isn't our culture. Come with our roots. That's really hard. And I think that's definitely 100% the foundation of where the problem is created. And with that, it goes from, okay, well, what are people going to say? So that's another added factor of, it's not like this innate homophobia. Like, there's no belief that homosexuality is bad, but it's more of, people are going to talk about you and gossip about you, and we can't have that. Like, we're going to be outcasted, ostracized from our families because everybody else thinks it's bad. Again, because of that colonial ideal imposed into South Asian culture. And so it's a lot of, it becomes almost like inescapable in a way sometimes to leave that mentality. And I think with some generations, changing and progressing, we do see some more acceptance, but it's for many, like from my research and folks that I speak to through my activism, a lot of it is comes down to, what will people say?
Absolutely. You make such a super important point that I want to delineate for listeners. And I know this because I grew up as a Christian pastor's kid. My dad has been a Christian pastor for 35, maybe going on 35 years. He'll be retiring soon. But I'm so keenly aware of the fact that in Christianity, there are false interpretations, I would say, but there are incredibly false interpretations of the Christian Bible that homosexuality is wrong. And I don't want to go down that path, but I make the point to say that so many people in the West that especially do grow up Christian, grow up with the narrative that there's something inherently wrong about who we are because of those false interpretations of what is in the Bible. But I want to contrast that with what you're saying, which is the fact that in India and South Asia, there's not that belief that you're inherently wrong as a human being, but it's more of like a cultural hesitancy, would you say, around queer and trans topics?
Yeah, definitely in South Asian culture, it's more of a cultural wrong rather than an innate like religious thing.
Right. Yeah, it just, I think that's an interesting thing to consider and reflect on, knowing how much colonialism has happened, you know, within South Asia and all over the world, quite frankly, which has been a recurring theme on this podcast, given that colonialism and its constructs have forced everybody into this binary of both gender and sexuality, and kind of makes a kind of moral statement on your value as a human being if you're a queer or trans person. So I think it's a super important conversation that we continue to have as all cultures around the world grapple first with colonialism and begin to deconstruct and decolonize all of our minds from these colonial constructs.
Yeah, absolutely.
So why don't you tell us a little bit more about your research specifically?
Yeah, so I started off in 2018 looking into queer South Asian women's experiences of culturally unique racism in Toronto's LGBTQ plus community. That was before there was a network or community of queer South Asian women together where I could even like find participants. So it was so hard to find participants then. But from that, I was able to kind of validate that, okay, these aren't just my experiences. These are pervasive and common experiences in our community. And from that, I then in my master's thesis went on to study the institutional mechanisms that are reinforcing this invisibility. So I did a critical ethnography of Pride Toronto, and I was actually able to find that invisibility is intentionally reproduced by organizations and by creating knowledge that is teaching people to continue, you know, excluding and invisibilizing queer South Asian folks and queer South Asian women, specifically also portraying this image and ideal of what a lesbian like looks like and acts like. And a lot of it also comes down to like, you know, you must be out of the closet and in order to be validly queer, and you must look this way. And so based on that, I then took a turn in my research and I started looking now in my PhD at the experiences of closeted queer South Asian women in across all of Canada. And I did a large study with 40 participants and essentially just kind of found, you know, what their experiences are like. And a lot of it comes down to, no, I don't want to give too many spoilers on the research studies you'll find, but parents have a denial response where even when some participants tried to tell one or more parent that, you know, I'm queer and, like, you know, try coming out, the parents were not willing to, like, they couldn't understand it. They were like, no, you're not. They didn't take it seriously. It was a complete, like, they just couldn't cognitively process it. And then even though they couldn't cognitively process it, it was sort of, there would be passive aggressiveness. It would actually be full out with family violence, which was really disheartening to see that be such a prevalent pattern in my research. Yeah, and it was very disheartening. And it's not just on the family side, but it's also in queer community spaces where because they were, you know, not out, they would feel a lot of exclusion in queer spaces or be shamed for it, be, you know, told like you have to come out, otherwise like this isn't okay. And another important finding too was that it actually increased the prevalence of domestic violence or made them more vulnerable and susceptible to it in romantic relationships. Because they are closeted, some partners felt like they could take advantage of that and be abusive and say, like, almost with the mentality of like, well, who are you going to go tell anyways? Nobody knows about our relationship, and then you can't out me. And for some participants, it was outright as bad as like, well, you can't tell anyone because that'll out me. And like, then you're a bad person. So it was all levels of fucked up, to put it quite bluntly. Like lots and lots of violence against queer South Asian women who are closeted from all angles. And it was disheartening because, you know, for me, like, and as I write about my own relationship experiences in my book and my own family experiences, I write a lot about, you know, here's my experience of violence. But to see that across a large sample of queer South Asian women in Canada have pretty consistent experiences, more or less, that's heartbreaking.
That's extraordinarily heartbreaking. And there's always reoccurring themes on this podcast. We haven't specifically talked a lot about violence, domestic violence. So I appreciate you bringing that to the light. But, you know, there's a lot of conversation on this idea that because queer and trans people grow up closeted, and, you know, from a psychological perspective and from like a behavioral perspective, we don't have access to kind of that same level of care that our heterosexual counterparts would experience with their parents. You know, and by that I mean, like you mentioned earlier in this episode, you're not able to go to your mother and talk about your relationships and how to kind of handle things that are going on in your relationships. And even when we were teenagers growing up, a lot of us, most of us, although things are changing now, luckily, but most of us had the experience where we couldn't share that aspect about ourselves with our parents. We couldn't pursue going on dates with the sex or gender that we're attracted to. And overall, it just continues to perpetuate these conditions of harm and trauma in our community, which I think leads to more susceptibility of being in abusive relationships.
Absolutely. I think so. I think like with that, there's also that added layer of, you know, the culture that you grow up in. And like, I know what I find with South Asian cultures, where often like folks who are socialized as like the South Asian daughter are taught to be, you know, like passive or be people pleasers, especially. So then when you have all of that vulnerability that's already existing on that queer standpoint, right, and like hiding yourself and whatnot, there's also that, okay, but like I need to please my partner and I need to just be okay with it and this is normal. And I think even from some of my own experience, I had very much a scarcity mindset where I was like, well, there's not enough South Asian queer women out there. So like, who else? Like, I don't have any other choices. And for me, like my dating experiences started off with dating a racist white lesbian. Like, I'm not even like exaggerating that, but she was very culturally insensitive. And so for me, it was like, I don't want to end up in that situation. So I just should just put up with this violence that is like, whatever, maybe she's just having a bad day. And so there's that, right? I mean, the other part of growing up sometimes as like a South Asian daughter is like, you're taught that it's like, it's okay. You could just fix this. You could fix people's toxicness. That's also something that I had to unlearn. And I know some other folks too, that I speak to in my community, I kind of come from the same mindset that we had to work through as well.
What was your journey like evolving beyond all of those cultural narratives into a more healthy mind state and approach to relationships?
Yeah, I actually had a very rough past 5 years with that. And so well in these like abusive relationships, that's also when I was like in my peak of being outed by family. So I had to like flee family violence and like get out of the household. And so it was like, I'm unemployed, I'm on my own, I'm super traumatized from like narcissistic abuse, to a point where like, it was at a time where actually I couldn't even string together a whole sentence anymore because I was constantly overthinking, I'm wrong, like this is gonna be misinterpreted, like I don't wanna get yelled at, and so scared of the worst I had ever been mental health wise. And I honestly wasn't really certain that I would ever come out of it. And so that healing journey for me, I did everything and anything I could. I've always been like pretty religious, spiritual, like with my culture, but I got really deep into it and trying to find answers. I actually started like reading all religious texts and trying to figure out, like, I had like some random post come up of like, if you read every religious text in the world, you'll have all the answers to everything in the world. So I was like, I'm going to do this. Like, I also have a really extreme personality when I'm like doing anything. So I got really into like that. I got really into healing with crystals. And I know that is something where some people are like, hey, that's a placebo effect. And like, whatever everyone else's beliefs, maybe for me, it actually helped a lot. And like, very surprisingly, like I didn't know where I was kind of going with it, to be honest, but I was like, anything that seems like it might help, like I got it and I took a chance on it. Like being unemployed and spending money on crystals, don't really know where we're going to get with that. So I did that. That's also when I became really into learning how the brain, like manifestations kind of work in like my healing process. So I couldn't afford a therapist. Again, I was very unemployed and I couldn't find a job either because I was also trying to finish my master's thesis. And yeah, so I became really into journaling and I tried to like basically learn from the internet, like how to heal and be my own therapist. Because I was like, well, if I can't afford a therapist, maybe I could just learn how to like everything therapists are taught and read those textbooks and figure it out. So like, it was honestly my only choice if I wanted to heal. So I did that. I really just like ripped through every like childhood script I could possibly work through. A lot of that inner child healing. I got really into meditation and guided meditations. I think at some point I even got a little into like those YouTube hypnosis, which I don't do too much anymore, but at the time it did really help me be really calm and collect, like try to collect myself during those times. And a lot of it was just focused on like reminding and telling myself that like, I'm okay. There's like going to be end and like, this is going to be healing. Like it's a journey. It's not going to happen overnight. And those kinds of affirmations, like I did not ever in my life think I would be at the point where I am at now, which is just being able to string together a sentence. Like I still struggle with disassociation and it's really hard, but the fact that, you know, I can now write an academic paper again, which I couldn't do back then. And I can, you know, think and I can have a conversation, even things as small as that. It's like, wow, like, okay, I can. And I can feel a little bit more confident again. So I think that was a very rough, hard healing journey. It was a lot of tears. There was a lot of what is wrong with me. But I think in the end, I was able to work through a lot of important beliefs. Like if it weren't for all of that, then having to really dig into myself, I wouldn't have realized that I actually had a deep held belief that I was inherently flawed. I'm inherently a bad person. I used to think that I was a really terrible person, despite not having any other evidence of that. Like I thought everyone was a good person except for me. And that also kept me in bad relationships and thinking like I deserved all of that pain when in fact I don't. And I know that now. It was a lot of realizing, well, like, nobody else deserves pain. And that's my belief. And why do I think I do? Right. And working through the scarcity mindset of like, you know what? I have faith in the universe. Oh, also really putting a lot of faith in the universe. Like I very much am like, if I ever am in need of finance or if I'm in need of housing, everything will work out for me. The universe will give me the opportunities that I need. And I've consistently seen that. And the universe will point me in the right direction. Everything that I need will come to me. Like I won't have to ever be depleted ever again kind of thing. Mm-hmm. All of that. Sorry, that was a very long, long answer, but spiritual awakening.
Spiritual awakening. I'm so here for it. I think what you're pointing to, and I'm going to talk a little maybe yogic and Buddhist philosophy here, just this whole idea that the Dharmic traditions have of, I want to use the word reclaiming right now, like you reclaiming who you are, you know, in the deepest depths of your being, because you're a South Asian queer woman. You know, India, of course, was colonized by the British and many other European countries. And so there's that whole like culture, like working through that aspect, working through the queer aspect, working through your parents and family's expectations about your identity. There's all these parts and pieces that you've had to work through. And it sounds to me like your journey has been this reclamation of getting back in touch with your, one of my Buddhist teachers, I love it, describes it as the center within. And I think that could just be known as the space of your true self, your true nature, as it's articulated in a lot of the Dharmic traditions.
Yeah, I think I'm like getting like that tingly feeling in my body. Like you just have like imparted the wisdom. I think, yeah, that actually sums it up very well because I'm thinking about it and it's like, you know, I grew up with my family and uncles and stuff being very into like their astrologers, into gemstones, like knowing that all this existed, but I couldn't really talk about it outside of my cultural family spheres. Because again, back then nobody talked about it and they thought it was like weird hippie stuff. But it does feel like on every level, like I decolonize my understandings of how I exist. I work with crystals and that's something that my family has done for like a while. Like meditation is something we've always done. And I always pushed it off as a child because I was like, no, like I need to fit in. Like, I don't want to do all of that stuff. And yeah, it's like, it's really all about, I think, decolonizing on every level. I'm thinking about it too, like really on every level. And one thing also that I learned during that time, before all of that spiritual awakening and like all that healing process, I guess sex, like I never really wanted to engage, or it was very like, oh, I have to like perform a certain way kind of thing. And it wasn't sex for pleasure, which back before in the colonial era when queerness existed, it was like, no, sex is for pleasure. Like sex with women, like you should enjoy yourself. It's very much like you don't have to orgasm. Like, you know, it doesn't have to be performance. Like it's just about every mutual pleasure for everyone. And I feel like that's something that I'm very grateful for learning, because now it's like I can actually be mindful in my like engagements, and it's not about like, okay, there needs to be like an end goal. Like it's not so much goal oriented, and I actually learned to just relax and enjoy experiences in the moment, not just like sexual experiences, but also just in moments with friendships, in what I'm doing, even if it's just step outside and smell the air and like stretch something, which I feel like is something that, you know, we know that our elders and our community have done, but we don't always just step outside and stare at the mountains, right?
Right. Yeah, I think you're like pointing to this whole, like what I would say is a yogic practice of like non-attachment, even Buddhist practice too, this like active emphasis on like letting go and allowing life to flow through you, and for you to genuinely experience life in all of its manifestations, pleasure and sex being one of the important aspects of human nature and experience if you're a sexual being. But yeah, just allowing those aspects that maybe were considered culturally taboo and still are in some cultures, allowing yourself to experience them without shame. That is powerful.
Absolutely. And I really do feel like once I allowed myself to experience all of this without any shame and just be one with myself is when I actually was finally had someone walk into my life that is not invading my boundaries or is not like, it's just someone who's very respectful and like giving back the reciprocal love in a very healthy way. And I feel like that's for me, I was like, okay, I think I did it. Like, I feel like that seems like the sort of like I'm at peace.
Right. Right. You mentioned a couple minutes ago that you like explored all of these spiritualities. Can you talk a little bit about that? How your connection to spirituality has evolved? Wondering, because you grew up in a Dharmic culture, and I don't know if this was your experience, but I know from being in relationship with having many South Asian friends, there's the idea that Western culture is so accepting, so I'm going to give up my South Asian culture. So I don't know if that was your experience. I know many South Asian people experience that from what I've learned. So wondering how you've reconnected. You may have experienced a lot of anger from your culture for treating you this way and for not accepting you. So just wondering if there's any like through way and connection back to your culture since you've been able to heal aspects of yourself. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. So to be honest, for me, I grew up in a very white town, and this is embarrassing, but I definitely thought I was white while growing up. And so for me, it didn't really like register that I was I'm a brown person for a very long time. And so because of that, I actually found it easier to accept my queerness, because I was like, well, I'm white. Like, what difference does it make? And so I was able to accept it for myself. But what happened after that was that I also then discovered that I was brown a couple of years later. And that's when it became really difficult, because I was like, well, I can't be queer and brown. So I tried to like, you know, hide my own sexuality and like try to be as straight as possible. It didn't really work. It didn't really feel authentic. And then I kind of came at a point where I was like, well, you know, I have to kind of find a way to live as both of these, and I shouldn't be excluded from either. So I guess, I think honestly, I don't feel as much anger towards my culture, because when I did also realize that I was brown, it came with an understanding of colonialism. In my family, at least, we've always talked about colonialism. I didn't know that queerness was removed from colonialism until like the fourth year of my undergraduate studies, when I started doing this research. And I think with that, I wasn't able to feel the anger, because I feel more, like I feel anger towards colonizers. I feel anger towards like the British Empire, towards people who are reinforcing these colonial ideals. But I just feel grief from my cultural standpoint, where it's like, I don't fault anybody in my culture. It's not their fault per se. It's the fault of colonizers who impose this. So I do have a lot of anger, but I think it's pretty correctly directed. And I think the rest of it is definitely, it's just grief. And I know grief is a mixed bag of like many emotions. So perhaps there is some anger in that as well, but a lot of it is just sadness, I think.
Well, first, I sincerely appreciate you taking my hard-hitting questions. I guess the reason why I'm asking these hard-hitting questions is I recently found out that queer story time in the sexuality category is it's literally number 6 in India right now. So I'm just like, I want you to be able to be a voice for other South Asian people that are listening to this podcast that may be having a similar experience to you. I just want to get back to the question of spirituality specifically, like how you have integrated your identity as a queer South Asian woman with any experiences that you have of spirituality or any connection to spirituality that you have right now as a queer South Asian woman.
Yeah, I will say that once kind of realizing how queer, like my religion, like Hinduism is, it was easier for me to accept myself and be okay with the fact that, you know, if my family's not going to accept me, that's okay, because it's not their fault that they can't accept. But I think a little bit of it was like, I'm not doing anything inherently wrong. God made me this way, right? Yeah, I think on my spiritual journey, it's a lot of just trusting the universe and trusting, like, so I don't talk about me being a religious person a lot, but yeah, I think a lot of it is just trusting God that, like, well, clearly I was meant to be a gay individual who was on this planet for a reason. Sexuality is not a choice. Like, I was born this way. And well, maybe like, this is just how it's meant to be. This is how it's meant to unfold. Like, I don't feel like I'm doing anything wrong. Like, I obviously feel sad for the people who are hurt in the way. And I know that, like, you know, obviously if I go out and tell everyone, that's going to hurt my mom, and that's not something I want. So how is the best way that I'm supposed to navigate this? Like, how do I live my life? And so I do think spirituality has given me a lot of peace, being able to really tap into that spiritual center. Whatever the best course of action is going to work out for me, and just trusting that has significantly improved my life. Because thinking back to when I did have a lot of anger towards my mom and my dad for like not being able to accept me. I don't know if it was as much culture, but it was more of like, it was just frustration. It was like, well, I don't understand. Like, the family is going to come around. Like, all you need to do is say that you accept me. Like, no one's going to leave. It's going to be fine. I had so much of that frustration that I was holding on to, but now it's just this transmuted into just this sense of like, this is how it was meant to be. And that's okay. Like, I just need to do what I can to keep myself afloat and, you know, find strategic ways to navigate being a queer person without telling my family. And so I don't know if that really answers your question too much, but definitely spirituality has given me the sense of peace that I needed to exist.
It does. It's an important message, because a reoccurring theme on this podcast is that spirituality has harmed so many people rather than healed so many people. So it's an important message that, you know, I want queer and trans people to hear, for them to know that there is a spirituality, regardless of whether it has a formal name, such as Hindu, Buddhist, Christian, Jewish, whatever it is, there is a form of spirituality that can reconnect us to ourselves, no matter what it's called. For me, it's such an integral part of us coming into a better formation and embodiment of our own identity.
Yeah.
Which is why I want to have this podcast.
And I think, okay, so this might be controversial, but I've had these, like, I don't know, just like, I've been sitting with these thoughts for a while and I haven't really known if I can like express it. So whatever, maybe some people might not like it, but I feel like many religious scriptures are subjective interpretations, right? I just really fundamentally do not agree with the people who are like, God does not want you to be gay. Being gay is against God. Like, no, it's not, right? Like, people wrote scriptures and people chose to misinterpret them. Like, homosexuality is not a choice, but homophobia is a choice, right?
Period.
Like, most of these religions are out here saying, like, you know, be peaceful, forgive people, be happy. Like, peace, kindness, and treating others with respect is the essence of most of these religions. So then how are you going to go and say, like, being gay is against God, and I'm going to impose, like, be so hateful towards you? Like, their homophobic actions are going against God's wishes in that case, right? I feel like people use religion, and a lot of homophobes hide behind the religious shield and argument to control people and try to force everyone to be heterosexual because of their own, I don't know, maybe they feel insecure, or like maybe they're feel whatever they feel threatened by the queer and trans individuals. They're hiding behind a religious argument to control people, and that's not the case. Like, they are taking religion out of its essence and causing it to be something that is causing so much pain for queer and trans individuals, when in fact, I do think that spirituality in essence can be a very healing factor. Like, God does not hate gays. We are all children of God, and God puts humans on earth, and sexuality is not a choice. God made gay people. God made trans people. Like, that's my hot take on religion and queerness.
I love this moment on Queer Story Time where people get all fired up and they start preaching. So I love it. Nothing controversial about what you said.
I mean, religion is, and especially in queer context, religion is very difficult to discuss because, like, I feel like people really go hard on the extremism. And it's like, I'm not an expert on religion, but I'm also, like, not uninformed, right? I've done my research, and so I can speak knowledge on it, but yeah, I think that that's an opinion that needs to be said.
Absolutely well taken. As a queer and trans Christian pastor's kid, like, I have not a damn issue with what you've just said. That's amazing. I want to ask for listeners that might not know, and now that I have you all fired up about religion, total change of subject, but I want to ask you what your definition of power dyke is.
That's so interesting that you asked that, because so when I was coming to terms with my sexuality back in, like, I don't even know, 2013 or 2014, something like that, I randomly Googled what type of lesbian are you as, like, an online quiz. And I swear I can never again find this quiz ever. And I've searched so hard, but I did it. And, like, you know, like, most of the tests are like, oh, you're a femme lesbian, you're lipstick, whatever. No, this quiz was like, you're a power dyke. And I was like, that's so fitting. Like, I don't like being caged into this, like, the femme category or, like, mask or whatever. But I did really like power dyke, and it was someone who is into, like, activism, community organizing, has this very, like, parental energy over, like, wanting to protect our community. And that's me through and through. That is me. Like, I feel like I am all in my queer mother energy of, like, I want to protect my children from the invisibility, loneliness, exclusion that we face. Like, we need to fix these gaps. Let's do it. Like, it comes from a very caring place. I think that's the balance of power dyke. The power dyke can give across, like, you know, I think it's a balance of, like, this motherly fierceness or this motherly, like, nurturing energy, but also the, like, the fierceness. Like, I'm angry that we're excluded. Like, I'm not here to fuck around. I'm here to create some actual change. And that is what I've done throughout my life. But I'm not going to harm anybody in the process. Let's do this in a peaceful way.
Ugh. Frickin' Allie, I feel so much love for you, and I'm feeling your power dyke energy. It's like, I feel your nurturing mother side and your fierce, like, advocacy side. And it's amazing to know that we have people like you in this community that really do want to create massive transformative change for our community and serve as that motherly energy, which is, you know, an energy that many of us don't have in this community, even you yourself. So you can be that for other people, which is truly amazing. So I'm just holding space for all of the healing that you have done in order to get yourself into this place.
Really?
So now that we're in our fields, I want to move on towards the super soul questions. And I always feel weird about calling them super soul questions because we're having a super soul conversation right now. But just as a couple questions to conclude this episode of Queer Story Time, the first question is, at this current moment, given all of your life experiences, what do you feel that your life purpose is?
I think very consistently throughout my life, I've known that my life purpose is to create and to bridge gaps and to fix and heal in the context of queer spaces, fixing queer spaces to be more inclusive of queer communities. And it's just, I think it also really hones into this, like, this fierce motherly, like, protect my babies, like, a sense of purpose of, I am here to create change, and I've created that change, but I'm not going anywhere until I'm done to the last day of my life creating as much change as I possibly can, whether it's creating through knowledge, through actual creating spaces, creating knowledge, writing publications and research to identify these issues in all forms, doing what I can to bring visibility to these issues and also bridge the gaps so that we have better spaces and a more inclusive future.
I love that. So, follow-up question on that is, because I think it's going to be important for you to articulate this, is how can, like, practically the queer and trans community be better about creating inclusive spaces for people of color?
There are many, many things that can be done, but there's one important one that I want to touch on, which is to not force people to come out of the closet and to give people that understanding of, you know, it's okay if you don't want to come out. You're valid in your sexuality if you don't ever want to tell your parents, and coming up with alternatives to be supportive. Like, I understand 100% that sometimes being a partner of someone who is closeted can be tough, or being a friend, and maybe you just want the best for them and advising like, here's, you know, maybe you should come out or whatever, but just don't go for the come out option. Go for what can I do to support you? And okay, let's figure out ways to keep you safe. I feel like that is one that is so important, because in, you know, South Asian culture, as like queer South Asian individuals, and not just South Asian, but in many like queer of color communities, it's not always as simple as, oh, I'm going to come out. For many of us, our parents immigrated here to give us a better life. So then why do we want to betray them? Right? Like, there's so many other factors at play. And it's, you know, sometimes our extended families, and like, it's hard to come out to them, or it's risking our parental ties and those broader family networks. So there's, it's not simple decisions. So really understanding that and seeing what you can do to support queer people without forcing them to assimilate to the white and Western ways of being queer.
Ooh, powerful words, my friend. That's super, super important. I love that you pointed that out to remind especially us white people that there are these extra cultural influences for us to keep in mind. That's super important. So thank you for that. Next question is, knowing what you know now and all of your life experiences that have led you to this point in your life, what would you tell your younger self about your identity?
You're gay. I would say, don't compromise your South Asian-ness and don't compromise your lesbian-ness. You don't have to be less of either of them. I just need to be authentically, happily myself, because I do think that there have been times in my life way back when I thought I had to give up my South Asian-ness to be queer, more like gay in a whiter way, times that I thought I had to be more South Asian. And that's also, you know, because I'm an Indo-African Gujarati, like, we're not like mainland South Asian people, like, it's different, right? Like, perhaps it looks more assimilated, but it's not always the case. Like, I don't have to fit any of those niches. I just need to take everything that I have learned and everything that feels authentic and just be me. I learned how to do that, thankfully, like 7-8 years ago, but it's been a good time. So maybe if I did that sooner, that would have been also very fun.
I love that. I love that. Next question is, and you can answer this just as like a personal message, or you can answer this from like your PhD scholar mind, or both, whatever you want to do. So the question is, what's one thing that you wish others understood about the gender and sexually expansive community?
There's a lot that I wish people understood, but one thing, the white way is not the right way. That's what I wish people understood, because as a gender fluid South Asian like individual, I know that I present as a woman, and that's, you know, not always intentional, but like if I was a white person wearing the same outfit that I am, I guarantee that I would be possibly even perceived differently. And if I said I was gender fluid, like nobody would bat an eye, or like people would use my correct like pronouns, whatever it might be. So I feel like if people were to understand that, you know, we don't all have to fit this like white norm of being queer as like a South Asian lesbian, right? Like I can have long hair, long nails, wider hips, and for some like larger breasts, and like that doesn't make you a feminine person. Those are traditional traits or features of South Asian bodies, of South Asian women's bodies, right? But you can still be a masculine presenting person if that's how you're trying to present, and you, that doesn't make you straight just because you look more feminine. So I think that is very much something that I wish people understood.
Absolutely. That was a fire response. Next question is, what would you say to all of these lawmakers globally that are creating laws against us?
So much. But really, I think it's, they need to actually use research-informed processes and talk to communities, talk to queer people. It's even things as simple as like, why are you criminalizing and like, you know, banning things like gender affirming care or like anything of the sort for queer people? Like, you're not stopping people from being queer, but you're forcing people to repress their sexuality, which worsens mental health outcomes and increases suicide rates. They're not stopping what they think is the problem. They're just forcing people to either hide themselves or forcing us to access things in unsafe ways for, like, when we end up, you know, going about living our lives and, like, getting that access to care, whatever it might be, that all of a sudden becomes something criminal, putting people into, like, incarceration systems and ruining their life outcomes. Like, it's just, these policy lawmakers need to use their fucking brains.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. Like, you're here to represent the people. So represent the people, not your personal interests of bigotry.
Hey. Yes, yes, yes. I love what you said at the beginning about research informed or evidence informed. That's so freaking important.
Yeah.
You know, not only as a future doctor, PhD scholar, but, like, let's be guided by research.
Exactly. Like, we do this research for, like, I do this research because I'm like, well, things need to be said about this community. The most, like, usually the most, like, respected way in, like, society is like, okay, there's research, so we'll trust it. But somehow lawmakers are like, yeah, research exists, but I'm going to advance my own interests. Like, why? For what? Research shows through and through. We need resources and services and access and, like, inclusive policies and legislation for, like, LGBTQ plus individuals.
Yeah, I've had the conversation with my friend Matt Ashcroft. He's still in his undergrad, but I don't know if you know Matt. He's Canadian. He's a Black gay man that survived conversion therapy, and he was one of the ones that helped pass Bill C-4 in Canada. And he and I always have this conversation that we need queer research done by queer researchers and scientists and physicians and all of that. I'm so honored to have you here articulating some of the importance of not only your research, but just queer research in general, because I do think that that's one of the only ways that we as a community, other than activism, but, like, having concrete literature, regardless of whether it's the field of medicine, psychology, sociology, you know, whatever other fields of study, religion, we need research done for us, by us. So calling all the queer researchers to come on to Queer Story Time.
Absolutely. We need queer researchers.
On a little bit of a lighter note, what would your number one tip, and I know it's a loaded question, all of these are loaded questions, but what would your number one tip be for queer and trans youth, and specifically queer and trans South Asian youth?
Don't give into the Western normative narratives that tell you that you have to come out to be valid as a queer and trans, like, individual. That, I think that's really important. Make sure that you have your safety net set up. You have a safe home to either go to, or you're, like, living on your own. You have your finances set up. Having financial security is extremely important. You need to plan for the worst outcome. Hope for the best, but plan for the worst, because you do not want to be stuck in that family household when shit hits the fan, whether it's your parents aren't recognizing it, or they're denying it, or they're just outraged, like, outright become violent in response. Like, do yourself that extra, that favor, and protect yourself. Like, it's okay to live a double life. Western narratives might shame it, but that's not the case. Like, do what you can to live your life safely. You are not in the wrong for living a double life. You need to do what is best to protect yourself. And you absolutely can. You have community spaces. Like, you have a Queer South Asian Women's Network. Like, we have spaces for folks who are closeted, who just want to come and be around a like community. You could still date and be in relationships. Like, you could do everything you do as a queer person without coming out to your family. Like, coming out is not some sort of stepping stone in order to be queer.
You're so right. It is a Western narrative that continually promotes, you know, the idea that coming out is going to give you some level of greater queer validity inside. And that's just not the case. I mean, you're a living example of that. So that's a powerful message. A couple more questions is, what makes you feel the greatest sense of connection in this world?
I'm going to tie back to spirituality. I feel very connected to not just, like, I guess, other people, but, like, yes, to other people, to myself, to me and nature just by really, like, I am one of many individuals on this planet. Like, we are all here together to do something together. We're all in this together. I don't even know how to answer your question other than just to just take deep breaths and remember that we are all connected and we're all living in this beautiful collectivist interdependent system, right? Like, and that's on a very larger scale. And 100%, when we really tune into this world, it can be very shitty. But many people can be very independent, as in, like, individualistic. But I think it's just thinking about, like, the higher purpose and the higher, like, spiritual plane that we can exist on as individuals. I think that's what helps me feel connected to individuals. It's not just focusing on, yeah, there's terrible things happening, but, like, what can we do as a collective, as humanity, to build and work to strive towards better futures?
And I can see that that's an integral part of your own spirituality, which I would say is very yogic.
Yeah, just always holding hope for a better future is something that has been a guiding light in my heart.
So with all of this said, where do you, Ali Patel, plan on going from here?
Honestly, just continuing to vibe every day. I am so grateful for all of the opportunities that I get. I truly am, for anyone who finds my profile or who sees me and is like, oh, I want to call in Ali for a talk, or I think you'd be great for this opportunity, this podcast, even, like, I am so, so, so grateful to receive opportunities like this. And I hope to continue receiving opportunities like this so that I can get my message across for queer South Asian visibility, because it's so, so necessary for us and for people to see this is what a queer South Asian person looks like. Like, you don't have to be queer or South Asian. You can be both. And I really do feel like, you know, just being able to speak and talk about these things, talk about our realities as queer South Asian folks, is so important. So my hope is that I can continue to get opportunities to speak at things and just get the message across on a larger scale.
Well, speaking of opportunities, how can people find you if they would like to get in touch with you?
Yeah, so folks can find me through my Instagram at AlyyPatel, or you can email me info@alipatel.com, like AlyyPatel. You can also check out my website, alipatel.com, and there's a contact form there, which can be helpful. Just spell my name correctly and you'll be able to find me.
Yes, that's Ally. Sincerely, Ali, thank you so much for being a part of the Queer Storytime family and so powerfully and fiercely telling your story as a queer South Asian gender fluid woman. It's been an honor to have you here. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I really do appreciate it. Much love and appreciation to you.
Thank you. And lastly, remember to stay tuned for episode 13 of Queer Storytime, the podcast, coming up near the end of July. And as always, if you would like to support my personal work and advocacy for the queer and trans community, and also this podcast, please click the Buy Me a Coffee link in the description of this episode. See you all next time.
Hey friends, I'm so delighted that you've made it this far. I sincerely hope that this episode has opened your heart and provided you with valuable insights into the lived experiences of those in gender and sexually expansive communities. There are several ways in which you can support this podcast. Make sure that you're subscribed if you haven't already done so, and be sure to share it with friends and family. Queer Storytime is a professionally produced podcast, which costs about $80 per episode. If you feel called to do so, I kindly ask that you support future episodes of this podcast by making a one-time or ongoing contribution that is sustainable to you. Links to contact me or to contribute to this podcast are found within the description of this episode. From the bottom of my queer heart to yours, I'm sincerely grateful for you tuning in to Queer Storytime, the podcast. Hugs and love, y'all. Until next time.
Tired of trying diet after diet without results? Mochi Health offers a long-term weight loss solution personalized to your needs. Our board-certified obesity doctors and registered dietitians provide expert guidance to help you succeed. Eligible patients can access custom-formulated GLP-1 medication at an affordable set price delivered monthly. Take our free quiz at joinmochi.com and use code AUDIO40 for $40 off your first month. That's joinmochi.com.